As the world marches towards a temperature increase of 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, one thing has been made clear. To reach the Paris Agreement goals of limiting warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, cutting carbon emissions won't be enough. But what does that mean in practice? Geoengineering is deliberate, large-scale intervention in the Earth's natural systems to combat climate change. Solar radiation management is arguably the most likely technology to be deployed. An appealing technology option for some, and risky endeavor for many, the lack of international norms or regulations on SRM research and deployment is a pressing diplomatic priority. You're listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, our guests Simon Nicholson and Jeff DeBelko dive into solar radiation management. What is it, and why should we be paying attention? Simon is an associate professor of international relations at American University and co-founder of the Forum for Climate Engineering Assessment. He's also a contributor to a new project we've launched with our partners at Adelphi called 21st Century Diplomacy. Foreign policy is climate policy. A former director of the Environmental Change and Security Program, Jeff continues to serve as a senior advisor to ECSP from his post in Athens, Ohio, where he is professor and associate dean at the Voinovich School of Leadership and Public Affairs at Ohio University.
Solar radiation management, geoengineering, these are terms that we've heard, but Simon, tell us what falls under this umbrella term. What are we talking about here?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, and nice to be with you. So solar radiation management is a term that's used to describe a set of ideas that might be used as part of climate change response. Solar radiation management would be about trying to reflect some amount of incoming solar energy back into space before that energy can be captured by greenhouse gases in the atmosphere and warm the planet. And so the sorts of things that people are talking about are, for instance, trying to introduce reflective particles into the upper atmosphere. This would be called stratospheric aerosol injection as a way to mimic what happens when volcanoes erupt, which has a cooling effect. Or another leading proposal is called marine cloud brightening, which is about trying to brighten clouds that are over the oceans, again, as a way to cool, in this case, regions of the planet. That broader term that you mentioned, Jeff, geoengineering, has been used as a while to talk not just about solar radiation management approaches, but also approaches that might remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and put that carbon dioxide into storage. But that geoengineering term as a big umbrella has kind of fallen out of favor in the academic and policy conversations about this stuff. And actually, it's much cleaner and makes a lot more sense just to draw a hard separation between carbon removal, removing carbon from the atmosphere, and the solar radiation management approaches that we're talking about today.
Terrific. So that's helpful. So even though we've heard the term geoengineering, we've kind of moved on and made progress by getting more precise. And so your work on solar radiation management helps us do that. That's terrific. So you've said that solar radiation management is an idea born of desperation. So what are the sources of that desperation for scientists, for practitioners, for civil society? Why isn't solar radiation management just one other tool that we have in our toolbox for combating climate change?
Yeah, I say it's an idea born of desperation because nobody would want to do it if the climate situation weren't so bad. I mean, this is not something that scientists or policymakers would be considering just because it seems like a need or a good idea, right? And the reason that I say that is because if solar radiation management were done well, that is, the science is right, the engineering is right, and the policy and governance frameworks around all of the stuff work, then solar radiation management could be a really important positive contribution to humanity's responding to climate change. You know, cooling down the planet could be the way to buy time for other forms of climate response to take hold. And solar radiation management as a way to cool things down over some defined period of time could just be really helpful for human beings and for planetary systems. But there are all kinds of risks associated with this endeavor, right? And so when I say born of desperation, we should play up the upside, potentially, of solar radiation management. But we really need to be attentive to the possible downsides.
Perfect. So key question on risk. A lot of ifs to do it, be something you want to do. So is this a new idea, or is it one that we're kind of newly paying attention to, maybe because of this imperative that you're talking about, things being so bad in terms of both climate impacts and our ability or inability to respond to them? But, you know, this it kind of transitioned from science fiction and the obsession of a few iconoclasts to now being something, as you said, that's on the table for practitioners. So how do we understand this in a historical context?
Interesting. Yeah. Well, it's in fact not really a new idea. I mean, the idea that one way to respond to climate change would be to try and reflect sunlight back into space has been around as a notion since at least the 1960s. There was a report actually that was written by a scientific body for the Johnson administration in the United States, a scientific report, and it was released in 1965. And it talked about spreading reflective particles on ocean surfaces, for instance, as a way to reflect sunlight and cool things down, right? And this is to say, Jeff, that of course, climate change as a thing in scientific terms has been known about for a long time, more than a century. And the basic fact that that the climate was warming has been known for many decades, right? And so this type of notion that we might respond to climate change in part through reflecting sunlight has been a piece of the climate response conversation for decades, but always on the fringes. Mm-hmm. It only really started to move from the fringes with a paper by Paul Crutzen, the famous Nobel Prize winning chemist, for his work on ozone depletion. Right? He wrote a paper roughly 20 years ago where he said, look, the politics of climate change is broken. We're depending on these political processes to force action on climate change, and we're just not getting anywhere. Maybe we need to start considering bolder technology-based forms of response. And he laid out the idea of stratospheric aerosol injection as something that might be done, right? Again, stratospheric aerosol injection is one potential way to reflect sunlight back into space. And because of his kind of presence and importance in the scientific community, the fact that he wrote about this stuff then gave license to other scientists to start researching. So the research kind of built out from there. And now, just in the last handful of years, we've seen, you know, these projections of a warming world. You know, the impacts of climate change are becoming manifest just far quicker and more brutally than was expected even just a handful of years ago. And as the international community says, what can we do to stay beneath these critical temperature thresholds of 2 degrees or maybe 1.5 degrees of warming? You know, the traditional ways of trying to respond to climate change may not be enough. And so what else could be on the table? That has led the policy community to start in nascent ways, starting to pay attention to solar radiation management.
So I want to come back to that foreign policy practitioners and what we have done and how this presents some challenges. But let's dig a little bit more into the two examples you gave us so that we can understand what this means or how it's done. So stratospheric aerosol injection, how would that work?
Yeah, so stratospheric aerosol injection would be one potential way to reflect sunlight back into space, again, by mimicking what happens when volcanoes erupt. So when you get a big volcanic eruption, lots of things come out of that volcano, including plumes of sulfur dioxide. And the sulfur dioxide, if it finds its way up into the upper atmosphere, into the stratosphere, then through chemical reactions, it becomes a reflective particle that starts to reflect some amount of incoming solar radiation back into space. So the idea is, could you mimic what happens when volcanoes erupt by introducing sulfur dioxide or some other reflective particle up into the stratosphere? And the easiest way to do that would be through high-flying aircraft, right? They would have to fly, you know, higher than commercial aircraft fly, higher than military aircraft fly, right? So this would require the invention of some new aircraft, no small feat in itself, that would then have to fly up into the stratosphere on a continuing basis to put these reflective particles up into the stratosphere. That's how stratospheric aerosol injection would operate. And if this idea were undertaken, then it would have a global cooling effect, right? Putting stratospheric particles into any piece of the stratosphere, they would start to disperse around. And so doing this type of thing in one place would have implications probably for all places.
Okay, so kind of technologically attainable potentially, but we're not there yet. So there's some new technology to be developed, as well as kind of the uncertainty on the impacts. How about the marine cloud brightening? Why would we, in this context, want the marine clouds to be brighter?
Yeah, so again, with marine cloud brightening, there's an analog which can be seen out in the world. The analog in this case are ship tracks. So when ships cross backwards and forwards across the ocean, when they're releasing soot out of the stacks on those ships, so particles of that soot find their way into the cloud layer, and you see the cloud starting to brighten above where the ships are traveling, right? And so if you look at images from space, you can actually see kind of white clouds forming above the paths that ships are taking backwards and forwards across the oceans. And so the idea here is to try and replicate that by taking, for instance, salt particles out of the ocean and spraying them up into the cloud layer above oceans. Those salt particles would act as nucleating agents for the formation of new or brighter clouds, is the thinking. Marine cloud brightening is an interesting proposition, in part because it could be used potentially on a regional basis. And so the Australian government, for instance, is exploring marine cloud brightening as a way to cool the area above the Great Barrier Reef, which is suffering massively from heating.
So in that context, then there is the prospect for kind of regional and place-based development and impacts, not strictly a global conversation, even if the impacts could potentially be global as well.
That's right. Yeah, so some marine cloud brightening has that characteristic to it. It could potentially be used regionally, which then shifts, of course, what we think about in terms of the international policy and governance conversations. There are also lots of potential ground-based or ocean surface-based forms of solar radiation management that could be explored. You know, brightening any feature of the planet would reflect solar radiation back into space before it can be captured by these greenhouse gases. So there could be some very localized place-based forms of solar radiation management that, if they were big enough in aggregate, could have regional or global cooling effects.
Well, that makes it even more interesting and probably more challenging then for this question of what it means for foreign policymakers and what they should think about. So on the one hand, from that global perspective, one could have shared interests around a global average temperature change. But if you're saying that some of the incentives here are place-based and specific, say, individual country-based, then you could see the diversity or diversification of interests that would make the foreign policy challenges even more so. So in that sense, tell us some more about why foreign policy practitioners should be paying attention to this in ways that go beyond kind of how we've tried to tackle climate change and these issues, and then maybe a sense of how you think we're doing in terms of the efforts to bring solar radiation management into those foreign policy discussions.
Yes, it's not like the foreign policy agenda is kind of wide open for new things, right? I mean, there are already lots of things for foreign policy folks to pay attention to, and the climate change response agenda is already itself an incredibly crowded landscape. And so one might look at something like solar radiation management, which sounds science fiction-y, and because this is only a set of research proposals at this point, it sounds like it's way off. One might look at this and say, you know, why should we bother about this now? And I think the main reason to bother about it now is because it's the sort of thing that could come onto the scene very quickly and could have massive and far-reaching implications. I mean, we're talking about potentially intervening in the climate system in a way that drastically reduces global average temperatures in a very short span of time, which could have massive positive implications, but could also, if mishandled, could have massive negative implications. And so this is the sort of thing for the foreign policy and governance communities that it just makes sense to get out in front of it, right? There's a need here for anticipatory governance to start to build the scaffolding, the infrastructure for long-term governance of this if it becomes a thing, that is, it's actually deployed. And to also shape research so that the right sorts of questions are being asked in the right ways to understand what's possible here, right? Get out in front of this thing because it's much better to try and shape something like this on the front end than to respond to it when it's suddenly in the world.
Is it fair to say that for a time there was almost a sense from particularly those who did not favor these kinds of massive interventions in the Earth's atmosphere, that if we don't talk about it, then maybe they won't do it. And so is it your sense that one of the reasons we're trying to play catch up and bringing this into a foreign policy discussion is that it was actually purposefully kept out of those discussions to try to make it a less acceptable intervention?
I think that's right. There's something to that, Jeff. Yeah, I think for many people who focus on climate change, this is just, this has been for so long such a fringe thing that they just didn't see any reason to pay attention to it. And at the same time, people have raised this potential that solar radiation management could serve as a distraction from the other work that needs to be done around climate change. Now, one thing to really be attentive to with solar radiation management is that it's not a fix. You know, this is not some sort of silver bullet. If we get the stratospheric aerosol injection right, then there's nothing else that you need to do. Turn down the temperature all as well. All one is doing potentially with solar radiation management is dampening that temperature signal, right? But all of the greenhouse gases, if they're still going into the atmosphere, then if that solar radiation management was stopped, you know, the warming's still with us, right? And so solar radiation management would be just one small piece alongside all of the other things that need to be done. You know, the main thing is still emissions abatement. That is traditional mitigation. Stop the greenhouse gases from getting into the atmosphere and then adapting to the changes that are already taking place. And so some folks look at that and they say, you know, solar radiation management, if it's only going to be a small piece, but somebody starts to think about it as a fix, that could be really dangerous, right? And if it's a distraction from the other work that needs to happen, if it's kind of dangled over the horizon as some magic silver bullet, that's not good for broader climate politics. And so you're quite right that there have been lots of people actively saying, don't buy into this agenda because it just takes us away from where we actually need to be paying attention. You know, personally, I think that's a really important consideration. But the genie's out of the bottle. People are already exploring the stuff, and you can't just imagine that not talking about it is going to make it go away. And so whatever one thinks about solar radiation management as a good or a bad idea, the governance challenges still remain.
That reminds me of why it was so difficult to get conversations about climate adaptation taken seriously, because there was a fear that it would undercut the momentum for mitigation. And I can see that potential here. But as you said, all these things, we have to walk and chew gum at the same time. These things are all present. And so we can't pretend that they're not on the table. So looking forward, what do you see as not necessarily the likeliest prospect, but what are a couple scenarios that you could plausibly foresee in how we move forward on solar radiation management?
Well, one possibility is a rational, well-designed, internationally cognizant research agenda shaped by international engagement from policy communities, potentially impacted communities on the ground, and scientists themselves. You know, that's one possibility, but the likelihood of that as the thing that will emerge, absent a whole bunch of work right now, is pretty slim. And I say that because, you know, we tend to muddle through. We don't tend to do the rational design stuff particularly well as an international community. So what's more likely, perhaps, Jeff, is that we're going to see, you know, a few different research enterprises pop up. The Australian government, as I mentioned, is looking at marine cloud brightening. There are some efforts in the United States to start outdoor experimentation around some of the mechanics and the chemistry of, say, stratospheric aerosol injection. And then people will respond to these experiments as they emerge, and we're going to start to see a co-creation of a scientific research agenda that's more expansive and at the same time governance apparatus around it. So that's kind of where we're headed at the moment. The scientists who are working on the stuff now say it's probably 10 or 20 years of research before they think they would know enough as a scientific community to actually do some of the stuff, solar radiation management, in ways that could actually start to shape the climate, right? So they're saying, give us time. Here's the research agenda that starts to do the work. Be ready for this in 20 or 30 years. But, you know, if the climate system starts to get really bad and we see governments or other actors start to get really desperate, then already enough is known about solar radiation management potentially for people to start trying it in a much shorter span of time, right? Steve Rayner, who sadly passed away just a short time ago, scholar in the United Kingdom, when he was talking about solar radiation management, he would often raise the notion, look, imagine floods in Pakistan, the Indus River floods. The year prior, the Indian government has announced that they're going to start exploring solar radiation management and has started a research program. Now, whether or not the Indian research program caused those floods, folks in Pakistan would say, you've done this to us, right? And so there are international political dimensions, even attached to just research, that are quite profound and that require the attention of the policy community, the foreign policy community right now.
That's a terrific example of where the perception can be as important as the reality in terms of what environmental security issues broadly defined or these kinds of interventions might be perceived in security terms that go back to underlining the importance of the political dialogue so that you can manage the management in ways that hopefully are done better than, well, the original assessment for why this might be necessary, that we're not managing our responses to climate change well. Well, Simon, thank you very much. We look to your writing on this topic in the past and in the future to help us understand these issues and bring them to the attention of the foreign policymakers that need to be engaged. Thanks so much.
Jeff, a pleasure. Good talking with you.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Wilson Center. Thanks for tuning in. For more information, follow us on Twitter at New Security Beat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.